Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Weather State Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, today we've got a phenomenal episode. And I'm going to start by just saying, okay, boomer, listen up.
We know you're out there.
And happy new year to you. We've got Laura Cusisto from the Wall Street Journal.
And what's so exciting about this is Laura wrote an article back at the end of November. It actually got a lot of play on a lot of forums and things that I follow. Okay, boomer, who's going to buy your 21 million homes? Now, this is a really interesting article, basically about a slow-moving crisis of generational change taking place in the United States, but also applicable to Canada. Who's going to buy the boomer mansions, the boomer dream homes? Gen Xers don't have the financial wherewithal. The desire, the need.
Save it for the show. But you know what the thing is if you're not letting an article like this at least inform your investment decisions to some degree, really, it's you're doing it wrong.
It's a slow-moving crisis.
It is.
but one thing that's interesting is she talks in the article about the Sun Belt and Florida, but Laura is actually originally from Canada, and so she's got a line on where this applies in Canada and also at a micro level, at a city level, which communities to watch for, which ones are in trouble. It's a fascinating talk.
It's super applicable to Vancouver as well, and it's just an interesting conversation, one that you're really going to enjoy. And happy New Year, everybody. It's good to be back. We took a couple weeks off over December, and you had a good Christmas, Matt?
I did, yeah. I spent quite a bit of the break at your house, actually. Your newly renovated house.
My house, we're back in. It's very exciting to be there.
Lots of
rummy, and we also played cards.
Yeah.
I call my rum rummy. And eggnog. A lot of rummy and eggnog.
I thought you were talking about your uncle.
Yeah, no, we did. We played a lot of cards over the holidays, and we also there was some puzzles. There
banged
was some
out a couple
kids.
Puzzles quick. Yeah, it was no, it was relaxing. It was great, but it's good to be back. It's good
it
to
is.
Be back and hit the ground running. The Roaring Twenties. It's been busy start.
It has been a busy start to the year. Did you have an inspection today or was that yesterday? You're already doing deals.
Well, I have an I had an inspection. This was actually great. I go to the inspection. We were looking at the common rooms, right? Because the depreciation report was a little bit older. Wanted to take a look at the mechanicals, the roof. I get there before anyone else. I meet the building manager. He's there, South African guy, older gentleman. He's talking about the building, explaining, you know, how it's a larger strata and how complicated it is and everything. I said, sounds like it's a pretty complicated job. He says, nah.
Are you going to do the accent?
No. He says, No. I used to manage an elderly care home. He's like, this is like assisted living. He's like, this is what I say is a walk in the park.
Yeah, that's a cakewalk.
That's a cakewalk. So I said, yeah, I think that makes sense. You know, assisted living. I bet a lot of people have a lot of time on their hands.
Sure.
You know, they're watching like a hawk.
Love he old says, people, but wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah. Job. And I think I got to do the accent for this part.
Yeah.
So I say that. He looks at me and goes, the worst, mate. It's the bitches.
Yeah. Wait, I don't know why I'm doing the accent. I'm actually thinking at this point you're kind of stepping backwards away from this
actually,
guy.
It was like you punched me in the stomach.
Yeah.
I was like,
yeah, you're just looking blankly at him.
Yeah.
And
I'm like, oh, yeah?
And
he goes, oh, they're the absolute worst.
Right.
And I'm like, what? How do I get out of this situation? Yeah. And then there's like a long pause, and I felt like
it's
a very
just the two of you. It's only the two of you. Okay.
And I was thinking, okay, this is like a very uncomfortable pause, right?
Right. You got to get out of this situation.
And then he goes, oh, mate, yeah, just hanging them, moving them. He's like, listen, finally, I said, get your family to hang these pitches.
Oh, pitchers.
Yeah, that's great.
Turns out he's a great guy.
He's a phenomenal guy.
The inspection went
loves
smashing.
His wife, loves women. He's a fantastic guy. So shout out to him. Well, that's a great story. Yeah. I honestly, we are both horrible at impressions, but I think you did okay on that.
Bang
one.
On, mate.
It was
spot on. Maybe I think it should have been spot on.
I don't know.
Anyway, we got to keep moving here. Let's get to the Oakland tip this week.
We do have the Oakland tip, Matt. We still have not figured out a jingle because Secret does not do his job, but we're just going to move forward with it. It is the Oakland tip.
So the Oakland tip this week is when you're listing your home, make sure to get a staging consultant at the very least.
Yes.
Now, what do we mean by this, Adam?
Well, here's the thing, Matt. Everybody fancies themselves a bit of a designer, and there's a good chance that you are. But if it's a hobby, you know, you want to get a second opinion. And the idea when you're listing your property is you don't want to have a really specific aesthetic that is going to be polarizing. You want to make sure that it appeals to the widest market possible. So what we always do, and as part of our listing package, is we provide a staging consultation with a professional stager that we know and trust. She comes through, she makes sure that your place looks beautiful, stunning, but accessible, right? And then gives you some advice. And you know what? Sometimes their houses or condos are 99% of the way there and ready to be put on the market. But even if you take one thing away from that consultation, it was worth it.
You know what? And the thing is, you could have the best style on the planet, but if you've lived in a place day in and day out for a long period of time, you're missing things. You're seeing it through a certain lens.
You got your Peaky Blinders up.
I'm sorry, this is getting offensive.
I don't know if that's
My point here is you know, people coming through an open, people coming through for the first time are going to see it for themselves with a new set of eyes, and that's exactly what the staging consultation is for. She's coming through, or he, to look at it from the gaze of the buyer, and that's what you
trust
want.
The pros.
Yeah.
And you know what? Every week we do a tip of our own.
Oh, yeah. We have a tip this week. I think it's your turn.
It is. You did the last one.
Holiday tip?
My holiday tip. One of the best things of the holiday for me is I got – so we had a family member visiting with their two kids, and they had this machine. It's called Bop It. Have you saw it? Yeah. Secret.
Took
I don't know.
Half you're, of my you're, holiday.
You don't. You've never seen Bop
no,
It.
No,
eh?
I've never. No, I don't.
I actually, I ordered one on Amazon. I liked it so much.
Didn't you order like three for the office?
I ordered a few, thinking that it went on forever.
I tried it once.
I thought it was the best thing I've ever done. Okay, so the concept is it's a small toy, a children's toy,
a piece of plastic.
But it instructs you to either bop it, twist it, or pull it. Okay, so you either hit one button, which is like bop it, you twist it, or you pull it, and then it speeds up over time, and you have to keep up with this. But the best thing about it is it's. You don't think of anything else except for bopping it, twisting it, and pulling it.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun. But then I realized it stops at 100 and you've beat the Bop It. And that was I realized that after I'd already ordered it. So anyways, my tip is anyone with...
Don't buy Bop It.
Yeah. No, my tip really is if you've never tried Bop It, it's pretty fun.
Yeah.
But it's a great... It gave us a lot of holiday joy.
It did. One, I would put this in the category of something that I already feel like this week I wouldn't have time to look at Bop It.
No.
This is only holidays. This is a holiday. Save it for next year, but Bop It was...
Yeah. Make sure you have a Bop It for Christmas.
And it's challenging. Like I did it maybe 150 times and I only got to 62.
Yeah.
But
are these tips getting worse?
Well, we're definitely putting more time into them. A lot of thought goes into our tips.
The Oakland tips are fantastic. Yeah, the point is to make the Oakland tips look good.
Yeah.
And we also have it's not hard. Yeah, and we have another sponsor as well. We're going to shout out to Raimi Films, RaimiFilms.com. Also doing Live at the Bento, which is where we host the podcast.
By the way, our next Vancouver Real Estate Live, I feel like we're hot off the last one, but
yes.
Next week, next Wednesday, we got Andre Pavlov coming down 7 p.m. on Wednesday at the Live at the Bento Box. We're doing Vancouver Real Estate Live with Professor Andre Pavlov, past guest. Guy's basically a genius.
He's amazing. And he's going to be joining us for a full hour Matt, remind me, what is the date? It's next
January 15th, which is Wednesday at 7 p.m. is okay. when we're going to be live at the Bento Box. Last time we had a fantastic turnout.
Yes.
A lot of questions. It was great.
So the idea, and just if you haven't joined us for Vancouver Real Estate Live before, it's basically just we're live in the studio with our guests. We're talking about real estate, anything you want to talk about. People are asking questions. It's interactive, it's phenomenal, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And you know what? Like, we like talking about the market. The nice thing about Andre Pavlov is he can go low. He can go as high as you want to go. If you're
high level,
no matter how sophisticated the question,
he's not going to troll you. Yeah, when our like trolls Michelle go Obama, low. Yeah. anyways,
definitely tune into that.
Yeah, definitely tune into that. And Matt, without further ado, let's cut to our interview with Laura Casisto.
Yeah, enjoy, guys. This is a real good one. Great start to 2020.
Okay, so we're here with Laura Casisto, U.S. Legal Affairs Reporter at the Wall Street Journal. How are you, Laura?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
Very well. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Laura, so we wanted to have you on because you wrote a very popular article recently called Okay, Boomer, Who's Going to Buy Your 21 Million Homes? Can you maybe start by asking you, why did you write this article?
So it began really an economist who I know and well and kind of work with a lot. And we'd worked on a number of different articles together. And he came to me and said, I'm kind of interested in looking into this topic of what's going to happen to their homes when the baby boomers die, because there are so many of them. Do you think people will be interested, or do you think that's too morbid? And I said, yes, I think people will be too. It would be interested, but yes, I also think it might be a bit too morbid. So we sort of tweaked it a little bit and looked instead at just the people dying and also people, you know, moving into assisted living, moving with their children, but essentially anything that meant that they were moving out of the single family housing stock. They were selling their dream home or selling their retirement home and not going to live in a home anymore. Not surprisingly, it just completely struck a nerve with everybody from baby boomers, but also Gen X and millennials, because it affects people of all ages, this question of all these homes that are going to come on the market, and is this going to be a great time to buy?
Well, the obvious question from there is it going to be a great time to buy?
I guess I should say there's actually sort of two sides of the question. One is it going to be a bad time to sell? And the other is it going to be a good time to buy? So I think I'll answer sort of first this question of is it going to be a bad time to sell? And I think yes, and thinking in a lot of places, you know, baby boomers who maybe built their big suburban dream homes, their 5,000 square foot homes in the suburbs, and thought this was going to be a great kind of investment. I think for some people, that's probably not going to prove to be true. The generation coming behind them doesn't have the resources and in a lot of cases the desire to buy those really big homes. And I think likewise for people who are looking to sell homes in places like Sun City, which I wrote about, which is a suburb of Phoenix in Arizona, these kind of suburban retirement communities, these like paradises for the old, that just kind of doesn't seem like it has the same popularity with the next generation. And again, so I think that's going to be a tougher sell. And the sort of flip side of that is, yeah, I'm not sure that this is going to be a bonanza for people my age. You know, I'm in my 30s, and certainly it's been a struggle to buy a home. But, you know, homes aren't going to be coming on the market in the places where I want to buy, in places like New York, in places like, you know, Vancouver, and these really great places to live to the same degree. There'll be some, but I think where we're going to really see a flood is in places where, you know, millennials, Gen Xers are just less inclined to live.
Can you talk a little bit about the shifting wants and needs in the housing market right now with younger generations?
Yeah, so wants and needs is a great way to put it, because I think people talk a lot about millennials only want to live in cities, they only want to live in walkable areas, and the sort of my experience reporting on the housing market, the data I look at, there's some truth to that. Millennials are more inclined than prior generations to live in bigger cities, to live a little bit closer in. But I think another way to talk about that is it's also driven by what's happening with jobs and what's happening with affordability. High-paying jobs increasingly have migrated to a handful of bigger centers, San Francisco, New York, Toronto, Vancouver, these kind of big cities that are real sort of magnet for talent and for business. And so people kind of have to live in these places. It's not that as easy to find a job in a cheaper place. And then there's this sort of second issue, which is just affordability. And housing costs have risen much faster than wages since 2012. And millennials are also, in a lot of cases, have student debt. They may not have as steady of a job as their parents. They're freelancing. And so they don't have the wherewithal to buy the same kind of homes that their parents did or to buy them as quickly.
Interesting. So it's almost, it seems like the shifts are not necessarily an individual, kind of the culture at an individual level as much as kind of at a macro level, kind of structural more.
Yeah, exactly. Like I think people think about a lot of it as being about individual choice and, oh, those millennials are so flighty and they don't want to buy homes. But I think actually a lot of the factors that are affecting them are just much bigger than they are. It's just about a changing economy and a changing housing market. Housing has just gotten much more expensive relative to income than it used to be. So it's not as easy as it used to be to buy that first home, to get into the market.
So which markets then, Laura, are maybe at the biggest risk?
And in terms of timelines here, because how do you see this playing out?
Yeah, so I'll answer the second question first. We are starting to see it play out now already. We're seeing baby boomers pass away or move in with children, you know, leave their single family homes in higher numbers than we were seeing in sort of within the long-term average. So we're already seeing about, 2 million people are expected this decade. More people are expected to exit the single-family housing market, to age out of the single-family housing market than the prior decade. So that's already a significant increase. And then by the time we get to 2020, we are looking at a pretty large scale. I mean, as the headline says, we're looking at 20 million homes being vacated by baby boomers. And that's sort of going to be, it's interesting to kind of think about how that will play out, because that is, that is in terms of the shock to the housing market. You know, we can think about it as being basically the scale of the bubble in the mid-2000s here in the U.S., which was enormous, right? Mm-hmm. And caused all kinds of problems. But it's going to happen much more slowly over a longer period of time. So there's some question about, does the market adjust? There's all kinds of bigger things that could take place. Immigration policy could change, birth rates could change. There's all kinds of big macro factors that could affect things. But I have no doubt that we're going to see some impact. There's just no way that we can see 20 million homes over 20 years put on the market and not have that have an impact. And so in terms of the places that it's going to affect, I broke it down sort of in my head as I was reporting on the story into three categories. And one, which is what I feature in the story, is a place like Sun City, Arizona. So these retirement communities, they're often restricted to people who are only 55 and older. They are really these kind of, they're like paradise for your grandparents. They have bocce ball and stained glass making classes. And, you never have to own a car. You can just drive your golf cart. And so they're like amazing places to live if you're 75, but they're not appealing places if you're 40 with kids.
We might have had a busy last quarter here, but it actually sounded pretty appealing, and
we're
kind
both
of just coming on 40.
I was dumbfounded by this article.
Who doesn't want to live there?
I'm just like a truth-telling moment. Like I went there and I thought I would hate it, and I was actually like, this seems great. it was cold back at home, and it was sunny there, and there were like as many swimming pools as you could ever want. And like, it actually, like, I was totally like, and people there look great. Like, people there, because you're really active. Like, there's things for you to do. You're not just sitting at home. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for it, but probably not a lot to be said for it when you're like 40 and you have two kids and a job, and it's not aimed at that. There's no school. There's no industry, nothing like that.
Right.
So those places, they're going to have a hard time because there's just not, it's not a clear model for how you rejuvenate yourself if you start to lose that older population.
And people, as I understand it, it's not necessarily that if you're 65 or 70 that this doesn't appeal to you, but more that the baby boomers are just such a massive generation that there's just not enough people with the wherewithal to afford it, or that are actually retiring to fill these communities.
Exactly. So if you look at Generation X, there are two big problems. One, that they're just not as big as the baby boomers were. And two, that they're not as wealthy. They didn't have as good of a time. The baby boomers, right, you know, famously born in the aftermath of World War II during a time of incredible prosperity. Gen X, you know, came of age much more recently, very different kind of economy. And so all the kind of data that I looked at showed that they have higher levels of debt. They're less likely to own a home. They're less likely to have savings. And so those things don't add up to a really cushy retirement in paradise. Those add up to somewhat to a generation that's going to have to work longer, that's probably going to just stay in their existing home. They may not even own a home that they can sell and use in retirement. So they just aren't going to have the wherewithal to fill the spots that the baby boomers are leaving.
Right, right. So you mentioned the retirement kind of communities, and you said that there were three in total?
Oh, so yeah. So I kind of thought of it in three categories. So the first category in my mind was the retirement communities. The second category in my mind that I felt was going to really struggle, that I saw was going to really struggle, would be what in the U.S. we would call these Rust Belt communities. And in Canada are probably more like sort of the center of the country, places like Saskatchewan, Manitoba, like places with older populations and that may not have as kind of vibrant and thriving of an economy, that maybe are not attracting young people in the same way. And so certainly in the U.S., like what I looked at was places like Cleveland and St. Louis, these kind of old, really places where you had graying populations and you don't have really kind of thriving industry that's going to attract people to replace older people as they move on. And then the third category were kind of pockets, like these kind of mini retirement bubbles in larger, more vibrant, more expensive cities. And so in New York, it was the Upper East Side. In San Francisco, there was Berkeley. There are these kind of places where, you know, there are neighborhoods that are old, that aren't that cool, that aren't that hip, but they're in places where housing is in such short supply and housing is so expensive that people will certainly move in and flood those places. I don't know what that neighborhood would be in Vancouver, but there's no question that in a place that's as expensive as Vancouver, that wherever that would be, if you had a bunch of older people move on, pass away, young people, even if it wasn't the coolest or hippest neighborhood, would move in just because there's so little housing.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because we've actually seen exactly that happening with the west side of Vancouver, maybe
certain pockets.
Yeah, Shaughnessy, Kerrisdale, where it was kind of the Tony neighborhoods that now the prices have come down, and in kind of more traditionally working class neighborhoods, the prices have come up where the gap between those prices don't necessarily make sense. But the traditional working class east side places are so much more vibrant, right? That a lot of people don't want, it seems like, at least the market suggests that people are not really interested in moving to those kind of quieter, more elderly neighborhoods now. So we're seeing that for sure.
We see that in New York too, absolutely. Like the Upper East Side, like no one I know lives there or wants to move there. But I interviewed people there who had moved there, who were in their 30s, who said, this is the best deal in town. Like I just sat down and did the numbers and it's still a great neighborhood and it's close to Central Park. And so, I didn't really care that, you know, there's not the newest bar or restaurant opening there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, that's exactly like the West Side. It's like we were talking to somebody not long ago. Well, we had a house where we sell real estate. We had a house 5 blocks from the beach, and we were saying, this is crazy. Like, it's 5 blocks from the beach, and people would rather be, you know, in the older industrial part of town paying fairly comparable prices because, yeah, there's a great cheese shop.
Exactly.
Maybe just thinking about how this plays out. So it's because it's interesting. 2008, especially in the U.S. and especially in some of the areas that we're talking about here, like Arizona and Florida, they got hit. They got kind of crushed, and it was very quick, right? Like, it was like the tap shut off. This sounds like it's a process that plays out over 20 years. Is this, I guess, two questions. One, is this, are people thinking a lot about this and how to tackle this issue? Or is this, are you kind of sounding an alarm? Or is this just something that maybe we haven't thought about or the general public isn't thinking about? And secondly, what needs to happen to kind of mitigate the risk here?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that actually surprised me pleasantly when the article came out, given the kind of negativity of the article, was that people in the leadership in Sun City, which is the sort of main place we feature as being kind of doomed in this scenario, they did not call or write and say, you're wrong, you don't know what you're talking about, you're just a journalist who's sensationalizing. They called and wrote and said, hey, can we share this article with as many people as possible? Can we, you know, we want to plan for the future, and this is a really useful tool for us to understand what's coming. And I was really happy about that. Like, I really was sort of appreciated that they sort of took it in this spirit. And, you know, I talked to them for the article, and they said, we're not naive about this, you know, kind of by definition, anybody who moves into this community has something of an expiration date, right? Like, these are people who are moving. This is probably their last home. And so we're constantly trying to figure out how to remake ourselves. But also there's a kind of strategy to that, right? Because it's like, you know, you're not going to remake yourself to be the next, you know, Williamsburg in Brooklyn, right? You're not going to be this super hip place. You know, one woman I interviewed said, we're not going to put in a rock climbing wall. Like, that's not what our 80-year-old residents need or want. So it becomes this question of, like, they're kind of finding this tricky balance of continuing to evolve in a way that keeps attracting new people to come there and enough new people without kind of losing, you know, who they are. And I think that's going to be the thing that a lot of communities are going to grapple with. Like, there, if you are a community that says you have to be 55 or older to live here, you're going to sort of face a choice of, do we at some point get rid of that restriction? And there was a place that I also interviewed where it's a new community that's under construction where they were going to make it 55 or older. And they looked at these demographics and they looked at what was coming and said, actually, you know what? We're going to put in amenities and services that will appeal to those older people, but we're not going to restrict it to that. We're going to kind of hedge our bets a little bit and try to attract people from different age groups so that we're not just relying on this one age group. So I think that'll be a really interesting thing that places are going to grapple with. But yes, I think some places were more prepared for it than others, for sure. I think some places had thought a lot about it, and other places I would call and talk to officials there. And they just weren't, I don't know that they were unaware of it, but they just weren't interested in making the kinds of changes that it would take.
Right. I wonder if I'm just thinking about on the local level here, thinking about, you know, even how you were mentioning in every city, there's kind of neighborhood by neighborhood. Like in Vancouver, it seems like this kind of aligns with the NIMBY movement, the Not My Backyard movement, which seems to be skew older in terms of people who are not interested in density or new development. And that kind of aligns with city planners banging their head against the wall in trying to make changes to these communities to make them more vibrant.
Yeah, one of the communities that I happened actually to visit for a conference while I was working on this story was Manchester, New Hampshire, which is not far from Boston. You know, probably depending on traffic, I'm thinking probably about an hour. And they have a very white and much older kind of aging population. And, you know, one solution for them would be to build something like a light rail, to build really great transportation to Boston and become essentially sort of a commuter suburb for Boston. But it's very divisive there because, you know, that would just completely change the character of the community, right? Like, it's been a very kind of quiet, community that's, you know, close to Boston, but not of it. And, you know, you start to build transportation, you start to build more apartments, and you're going to have a busier place. And that doesn't necessarily appeal to current residents of those kinds of communities. And so that's a tough question you have to grapple with, because you, if you want kind of a future for your community, you may have to adapt to some of those realities, allow new housing, allow transportation to be built. But yes, you're totally right. For older homeowners who've lived there forever, they don't want to see that kind of change.
Right. And presumably it's going to take that the house is going for sale and the shifting demographics and the changes, but it's probably going to be a fairly long, drawn out, painful process to get those communities to where they probably need to be to be appealing for younger generations.
Yes, no, I think that's exactly right. I think long, drawn out, and painful are the perfect adjectives for that.
And I'm just thinking here in terms of long, drawn out, and painful. What can you talk about the kind of apart from kind of single sellers, the larger potentially long, drawn out, and painful implications for local, regional, and even national economies?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think when I was writing the story, I thought a lot about this, and I felt like I could answer the kind of the local, regional question, which is I do think that it is a challenge for these places, and you can look to aging communities in the Rust Belt already to know that it is a challenge if the population starts to decline, if home values start to flatten out or even fall. You lose that property tax base, you lose that kind of employment base, and you do see kind of these places then struggle to provide the same kind of quality of services that they used to provide, and then it becomes something of a vicious cycle, because it's hard to attract people to move in. You know, I should say, I don't think, kind of for the reasons we were just talking about, I don't think this is inevitability. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion. I think places, if they see things coming, if they plan for it, they can adapt their economies. Like a place like Sun City, for example, that's so close to Phoenix, which is a pretty vibrant metropolitan area, there's hope for them to kind of adjust, but it becomes a question of do they? And if they don't, I think you definitely do see a local economy that's likely to suffer, just as you have fewer people spending money, you know, fewer kind of affluent boomers able to kind of spend on services, restaurants, and that kind of thing. I think the national economy, we spent a lot of time, I talked to my editor a lot about this, about what we could say about that. That's very difficult. I mean, I don't think there's any question that the aging of the boomers, that the loss of the boomers is a long-term challenge for the economy in the U.S. and in Canada. But there are so many ways that policy could respond to that. So, immigration is a big question. That's a very hot, sort of sensitive political topic here, but just from a purely economic perspective, you know, if you open the spigot and let in more immigrants, that could replace some of the boomers that are being lost. Or it just becomes a question of, you know, how does the economy change? You know, does it become an economy that's more centered around these centers where we talk about younger people wanting to live at the expense of other places? And what does that mean, that kind of inequality between cities, if New York and San Francisco are really winners in this scenario, but smaller cities are kind of losers? That's a big challenge for the economy, too. So I think there's, that's like, I think that is probably a book for somebody to write, probably yeah. not me. Like, I think it's not an easy question to answer at all. But I think it's something people are going to be thinking a lot about and writing a lot about. So, cause it is, it's sort of the big challenge right now.
Also, yeah, the economic challenges there, but also the political challenges, because that's the kind of inequality that seems to be driving the divisive politics of the age, presumably. It sounds like this potentially just adds fuel to the fire.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think you potentially end up, yeah, with a situation where you have vibrant cities that are also expensive cities where a lot of people can't afford to live, and then cities that are affordable but where they don't have the same vibrancy and the same jobs. And we certainly see that developing in the U.S. economy already, and this could exacerbate that. And that is, it is a political problem. It creates resentment and misunderstandings, and it's a big challenge here.
So maybe we'll leave it there. We have this section called the Five Wire as well that we'd love for you to stick around with the New York version. But I just had one question. We usually have a tell us about yourself section at the start, which we didn't do today. But you're so you live in New York City. You work for the Wall Street Journal, but you're originally from Regina. So you're a Canadian in working for one of the major newspapers in the U.S. in this kind of pivotal moment. It sounds like you were back in Canada for the holidays, and presumably everybody was asking you for some sort of insight or dirt from the newsroom about what's going on in the States. Anything interesting?
What's the goss?
And we can edit it if there's no goss, but presumably yeah. there is.
Well, I was going to think of... I don't know what I'm allowed to say. Probably
this
not.
This is a confidential conversation.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of
deep throat. Somebody, you don't have to name names.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's anything sufficiently interesting that I'm allowed to say.
Sounds like an interesting position to be in, though. If you have yeah. a bunch of things that are not allowed to be said.
Yeah, no, there's no question it's a really fun time to work at an American newspaper, I'll say that much.
So, Laura, so you can stick around for the Five Wire, five quick questions, usually
sure.
about Vancouver, but today it's the New York edition. So question number one is, what is your favorite area in New York?
My favorite area, so I lived there until recently, about 8 months ago. My favorite area is an area called Fort Greene, which is in Brooklyn. It's kind of just off of downtown Brooklyn, but I have a dog, and it has this amazing park where before 9 a.m. you can take your dog and let your dog run around wherever they want. And it is a kind of really fun, interesting neighborhood. It was a sort of really kind of vibrant, wealthy African-American neighborhood for many years, and then was very dangerous. This is, you know, the story of lots of neighborhoods in New York. It was called Bang Bang, Shoot 'em Up for Green or something like that. It was super dangerous. And now it's just a very kind of fun place with a lot of kind of people who work in the arts, all the way to bankers who own townhouses, lots of stuff to do, very kind of little microcosm really of New York.
So a more interesting place in the Upper East Side.
More interesting in the Upper East Side, yes, exactly. But the polar opposite of the Upper East Side, where 30 years ago, no one would have chosen to live. No one kind of who had all the money in the world, no one who could afford it, would have chosen Fort Greene over the Upper East Side. And now lots of, you know, Fort Greene is also super expensive, you know, probably more expensive than many places in the Upper East Side, but people would choose that for what we talked about, for the great cheese store and the the good music store, that kind of thing.
Right, right. Favorite bar or restaurant?
Probably also in Fort Greene, it's this place called Miss Ada, which is a really great Israeli restaurant that was around the corner from our apartment, and my husband went to it and I went to for many years, and this is like a great New York story where now, and it was not, you know, kind of not well-known or anything like that. And now it's getting lots and lots of press and lots of coverage, and it's actually kind of, I think, getting the due that it deserves. I also, because my husband always makes fun of me for this, should mention that I do still think the best brunch I ever had, though, was in Winnipeg at Clementine, which my husband always makes fun of me for, because there's all these great brunch places in New York.
But world-class city.
I still think Winnipeg takes it.
Speaking of weathering the storm, well, Winnipeg. Yeah, we're originally from Winnipeg, so we can speak to, I don't know if I can speak to Clementine, but it is a world-class city, there's no question.
One book you would recommend that our listeners read?
So I don't know. I don't know if this has been as popular in Canada as in the U.S. It's been within a certain circle super popular here, but it's a book called Evicted by a guy named Matthew Desmond. He spent years living in a kind of lower income community in Milwaukee and writing about eviction there. And it is, like, to me, it's just the most amazing, as someone who writes about, has been writing about housing and thinking about how to write about it. Eviction was such a hard thing to cover because it's not like one big dramatic event. It's just like a slow trickle of lots and lots of small cases, small events in people's lives. And he just did an amazing job of making it into something that people could really understand as a bigger issue and a bigger topic. And I recommend it to lots of people who are really interested in real estate. And I also recommend it to people who know nothing about real estate. And everybody seems to really, it just seems to resonate with everybody a lot.
Interesting. If you listen carefully, you can hear all the landlords listening to this program downloading that on Audible.
There you go.
one piece of advice that you would give your 18-year-old self?
I think probably just that nothing is permanent. It took me a long. I felt like I put so much weight in all of the decisions that I was making around that time in my life, you know, around every class I chose to take, around where I was going to go, what I was going to do after undergrad. And I ended up doing, I did a master's degree in poetry at U of T. I did a year of law school at U of T, and then I went to journalism school in the States. And, you know, I think I felt like I felt really kind of bad about myself that I hadn't taken a clear, straight path. But all of those things have been useful. All of those things have ended up adding up to the career that I've had. And I wish I sort of had been able to just, like, enjoy those things each in their own moment, kind of knowing that it would, you know, that nothing was, no decision was permanent, no decision was irreversible, which is, I think at the time it really felt like every wrong step was going to haunt me forever.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's great advice. That's sounds familiar.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yes.
No, that's very useful. So a last question for you, Laura, something you have purchased for under $1,000 in the last year or two that has had a really positive impact on your life.
Let me think about that for a minute. So in the last year or two, something that I purchased for $1,000. So this is a little bit longer ago, but this is like a little bit, yeah, like a little while ago, but when I had kind of first moved to the U.S., and I was not making very much money, I spent all my time in New York, and New York is this very kind of specific, the word now is bubble, but yeah, it's this very kind of, it's very different than a lot of the rest of the U.S., and so I wanted to travel and I wanted to see other cities, but I didn't really have the money to do it. And so I took overnight buses, overnight Greyhound buses from city to city, and went to Philadelphia, and Charleston and Atlanta. So got to kind of see, and Richmond, Virginia. I got to see all these kind of Southern American cities for basically no money, because I would sleep on the bus, you know, so it was just had this, so the cost of the bus ticket and the cost of food. So it was all I'm sure added up to less than $1,000. I felt like kind of gave me my first real kind of taste of the U.S. And also, like, coming from Canada, these were places that, like, New York is not in a lot of ways that different than Canada. It's a very big city, but, you know, people are pretty similar. People sound similar. People have kind of similar life experiences. And that was like just a totally, that was just a totally different world. And I think gave me a real sense of kind of inequality in the U.S. and how much starker it is than Canada, but also like fun things like how there's like how amazing Southern food is and all this kind of stuff. So I think that was like that was money well spent when I didn't have very much money to spend at all.
Yeah, that's a good. That's the first time we've had Greyhound bus tickets, but that's a great answer.
And only the second experience we've had.
Yeah.
Okay.
Usually it's AirPods.
Usually it's AirPods. I don't have AirPods. My husband keeps trying to get me to get them, but so maybe if that really would change my life, maybe I should break down and do it.
well, maybe we'll leave it there. But Laura, how can people find out more about what you're doing and your writing?
Yeah, great question. So I do have Twitter. So it's at Laura Kusisto, which is Kusisto. You should definitely check out the Wall Street Journal. And there are lots of other great writers here other than me who are writing about tons of interesting stuff. That's how you can kind of keep in touch.
Do you ever go back to Regina and say, I'm writing for this little publication. Maybe you've heard of it.
Yeah, my grandma actually, to this day, I think still really wants me to come home and write for the Leader Post. It's just too cold there. I've gone soft. I don't own proper winter clothing anymore.
Right on. Well, thanks again, Laura. That was a fascinating conversation. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you guys. They were great questions. I really enjoyed it.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Laura Kusisto from the Wall Street Journal.
Really enjoyed that conversation with Laura, Matt, and I am excited to get back to New York now. That was some insider access.
Yeah, that was great. I know for those listening who don't know, I lived in New York for a bit, and you spent quite a bit of time on my couch.
I did. Yeah, I spent 3 weeks. This was around 2005.
Yeah.
And pro tip, if you're visiting New York, don't make the mistake I made. It's pronounced Houston Ave, not Houston Ave.
I still remember when we walked in that dive bar and you yelled, "Houston, we're in the building."
Yes. And then at the end of the night, I yelled, "Houston, we have a problem." Second pro tip, if you are in New York, you got to check out Biggie Smalls' hometown, Brooklyn. I never was really good at pronouncing names. Anyways, Matt, what else do we have before we cut for the week?
What else do we have? We have our website, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. We should say we're done with Vancouverism. We
gave away our last book.
We might have a couple more,
right.
But we're turning over a new leaf in 2020. Thank you all for the reviews. That was really great, and we still have a couple more to deliver. But anyway, so thank you for that. The rest, what else do we got? We got VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Yeah, we do. And we should say it is 2020. It's starting. The year is ramping up. Thank you so much for joining us in 2019, and we really appreciate you coming back in 2020. This is going to be the best year yet for the podcast. We are also available to help you if you want to buy or sell real estate in 2020. We have our goals down, our real estate goals, and what we want to achieve this year. And really, your goals are our goals as well. So we're super excited about 2020.
Absolutely. And if you want to just monitor a market or get on our mailing list, head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com where you can see things like the Livewire. That's our weekly newsletter. You're going to see stats before anyone else. We got
sales ratios going out. Like, our stats are the best. There's no question about that.
For sure.
We also got that research tool, Private Client Services.
Matt, if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor-level information at your fingertips. It's free. It's the best research tool for looking for Vancouver real estate that we've ever seen. It really, and we've tried them all. It's phenomenal. You got to get on there. It's free on our website, VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
But yeah, other than that, just remember, next Wednesday, 7 p.m., live, Vancouver Real Estate Live. That's going to be great on YouTube. And
Andre Pavlov,
wow. the one and only. If you want to talk about that or buying or selling or anything else real estate related, give me a call at 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
We also got that secret line.
info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Nice. I don't have anything to say about that. That was pretty good.
Have a good week, guys.
It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and pepper and Heavy D up in the limousine. Hanging pictures on my wall. Every Saturday, Rap Attack, Mr. Magic, Molly Mall. I let my tape rock to my tape.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.